Happy Monday, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to Help for HD Radio. This is your host, Melissa Biliardi, and tonight our call-in numbers are 310-982-4227 and 877-497-4103. That's a toll-free. Call in and press 1. We'll cue you into the show and ask. You can ask questions. Please tell your colleagues, friends, and family about Help for HD Radio and click follow on our show page to get email reminders of upcoming episodes. Today we are literally at 45,000 listeners, thanks to all of you. Incredible amount of listeners at this point. Our amazing special guest tonight is Ira Scholson, MD, Professor of Neurology, Pharmacology, and Human Science, and Director of the Program for Regulatory Science and Medicine, PRSM, at Georgetown University. Dr. Scholson founded the Parkinson Study Group in 1985 and the Huntington Study Group in 1994. These are international academic consortia devoted to research and development of treatments for Parkinson's disease and Huntington's disease and also related neurodegenerative and neurogenetic disorders. Among many prestigious endeavors, he has served as principal investigator of the National Institute of Health, NIH, sponsored trials for the therapy of Parkinsonism, and more than 25 other controlled multi-center studies, I'm sure, a lot more. It is an honor and a privilege to welcome back to Help HD Radio, Dr. Ira Scholson. How are you tonight?
I'm fine. Thanks so much for having me again, Melissa.
It's so good to have you back on the show. The last time you were on was in May. It was May 9th of 2011. That's a long time ago, and I'm sure a lot has happened since then. At HSD, and I'm sure at your Parkinson study group too, but what is new at HSD?
Yeah, well, happy to answer that. First, I'll say a lot has happened new with you. I guess this is, what, your 121st show, mm-hmm. and having 45,000 listeners now. So just want to recognize that, although I'll tell you about a lot of new things from our end, there's really a lot of tremendous progress and growth from your end. So I congratulate you and, and James and the whole crew, and I'm really pleased to continue to be part of this. So, yes, about what's new in the Huntington Study Group. Well, first I should explain for listeners who may not know that the Huntington Study Group is a worldwide collaborative research group of researchers, and these are clinical researchers, who work together to develop better treatments for Huntington's disease. And we, as you mentioned, we were founded back in 1994, and our 19th year of existence. I should also point out that over this period of time, we have been responsible for developing and conducting more than 25 clinical research studies, what we call clinical trials in Huntington's disease. Some have been very big, some have been small, some have been long, and some have been short, but we continue to do this. This is our core interest. And when I say collaborative, I'm also referring to the fact that our researchers are clinicians, largely physicians, but these are clinicians who not only do research, but they're involved in the care of patients and families with Huntington's disease. So, as we say, we have one foot in the clinic and one foot in the research lab. So that's what the Huntington Study Group is, and a lot of things are going on. As far as our core work of clinical trials that I mentioned, we have 6 or 7 active ones right now, depending on how you count it, with a new one starting up in a few weeks or months. And we're on schedule to keep starting up studies once or twice a year, and we've been doing that for the past few years. So that's really an overview, and if you're interested in the particular studies, I'm happy to go over them with you.
Fantastic. Dr. Scholson, I just want to kind of preface some of the questions that I'm asking you tonight. You know, I get hundreds of emails every day from the community, from the different groups that I belong to, and I've been watching over the course of the past, 18 months or so, some of the trending questions that kind of pop up regarding clinical trials and studies and what the scientists, how do they figure out what drugs to work on and this and that. So some of the questions that I'll be asking you tonight are going to be kind of a compilation of, based on some of the questions that I've been getting in the community and some of the comments that I've seen throughout the weeks, months, so forth, of people in the community looking for answers. So, but I wanted to ask you first about the 6th Annual Clinical Research Symposium, and that happened in November, and I was wanting to know if there's anything published yet on that symposium, or do you have any video or anything that we can share within our community here?
Yeah, well, we publish let me explain, the symposium as part of a day-long get-together, which is comprised of a scientific symposium and then a workshop, and the clinical community in which we're visiting is invited to this. And last year we were in Seattle, Washington, and we had over 250, 60, 70 attendees that were part of this, including, of course, the researchers, but really a solid representation of patients and families in the area, some of whom traveled for hundreds of miles. So there's kind of two parts of it. One is the scientific session, and the other is the educational session that we have in the community afterwards. The scientific session, there were several what we call keynote addresses that really highlighted important developments related to HD. One was a presentation actually by a colleague of mine who's a psychiatrist in the Banner Alzheimer's Institute in Phoenix, Arizona, who together with really an army of colleagues in the United States and also in Colombia, South America, put together a study to examine what happens to people who come from families where there's a really high hereditary occurrence of Alzheimer's disease. So it's very parallel in a way to Huntington's disease. Unlike Huntington's disease, Alzheimer's disease is contributed to by many different genes, and Huntington's disease is a single gene. But in Alzheimer's disease, there are some single genes that give a hereditary pattern that looks very much like Huntington's disease. The clinical features of the disease are different between Alzheimer's and Huntington's. But to make a long story short, they pulled together this really remarkable global study whereby individuals in Colombia, South America, who have at risk for developing this condition are brought to the United States for evaluations, including some high technology imaging techniques. And then also there's an experimental drug that's being investigated from an industry partner, and this is also supported by the government, to carry out a long-term study over 10 or more years to examine what happens to these individuals. So this is obviously relevant for HD because we really have a similar type of situation. It was nice to know that other people are using this type of approach and strategy that we are. So that now, was, go ahead,
this,
why don't you?
Is this Dr. Terrio?
Terrio, yes.
Okay, now are you referring to the government as being the Colombian government or our government?
No, well, most of the money is coming from our government in the U.S., the National Institutes of Health, but it's with good cooperation of the Colombia government. It's, in a way, it's not too different from our Huntington's Venezuela experience.
I was thinking that
we had about 20 years ago. So this is really one of those cooperative efforts. It's big research, big science, but we had Dr. Terrio there to share that with us, and we'll be following that experience. Go ahead. You were going to ask me something else about
that's
it.
So interesting. Do we have any new statistics relating to prevalence And that's one part of the question. The second part of the question is, would it be different in different countries?
We're talking about the prevalence of HD.
Yes.
Yeah. So one of the other keynote addresses at the symposium was given by Blair Levitt of the University of British Columbia. He's a neurologist scientist there. And he's been working with his colleagues for several years, particularly Michael Hayden, to study data, what we call epidemiologic data, that really kind of sorts out the prevalence, the occurrence of HD, particularly where they are in Canada, but also worldwide. And they have done some, they have revisited their data as they accumulate more over time, and it's become apparent that the prevalence or the occurrence of HD worldwide, and particularly in countries where people are living longer, is really steadily increasing. So when we talk about the prevalence of HD of 10 individuals per 100,000, it could be much higher. It could be 50% more, that is 15 individuals per 100,000, or maybe even higher than that. And there's also been separate studies in the UK and in Great Britain in certain areas where they have good records from primary care physicians to suggest that, you know, it's that high. So that it really has a big difference. The other thing that Dr. Levitt pointed out in his talk is there's more and more individuals who fall in this intermediate gene repeat level, and as they live older, there is a potential that more of these expansions will occur, and therefore more individuals with HD. So it was a very sobering look at that, and also very important for clinical research, not because we have more research participants, which is important too, but we also, and sponsors also recognize that maybe this is not quite as rare as we thought.
Would that have any bearing on the fact that HD is considered an orphan disease or a rare disease?
Well, there's no question. Yeah. Well, first of all, Alzheimer's disease, just to give a perspective, there's approximately in the United States 4 to 5 million individuals with Alzheimer's disease. Huntington's disease, we're talking maybe it's 30,000, 35,000, or around there. So I don't want to give an indication that it's a very common disease. It's still a rare disorder, but instead of maybe 30, 35,000 people in the United States, there might be 40 or 45,000 people.
Right.
I mean,
you're
getting a sense from your reach that there are a lot of people who are interested, and of course, for each person affected, there's a number of people at risk. So I think, and it's still an orphan disease technically, as the Food and Drug Administration defines it, one has to have less than 200,000 affected individuals to be considered an orphan disease. And there are, the FDA, if it is an orphan disease, gives to the sponsor of a new medical treatment for that disease some tax incentives and other goodies to really encourage the development for rare disorders.
Mm-hmm. So we kind of don't want it to be, we want it to be more of a lower number at this point until we really know what the numbers are, right?
Yeah, well, it's not going to approach 200,000. There's no question about that. Listen, what we all want it to be is zero, but
exactly.
That's another story.
right. Okay, so then as far as the symposium and what the speakers covered, the keynotes covered, is that going to be published anywhere?
I didn't answer you. That was your original question. So every year we publish this in a journal called Neurotherapeutics.
Okay.
We have all our back symposium where we publish this, and it comes out in the first quarter of 2013. So it'll be out either this month or next month, and the name of the journal is Neurotherapeutics. And I'm happy. We put this up on our website at the Huntington Study Group so people can get a link to if they want to review the abstracts or anything like that. So that goes up every year. And I'll also mention that our 7th annual symposium will be coming up in the fall, probably in early November in the Charlotte, North Carolina area.
Okay.
So we're continuing this effort to move around to the various communities, and we're really pleased with the wonderful reception that we get from the communities and the ability to not only educate about Huntington's disease, but we also educated the professionals in the community last year in Seattle and this coming year in North Carolina.
And you have Dr. Mary Edmondson in North Carolina, so she's going to be able to really do a lot of good things in her community with that, right?
Yeah, well, we have a local organizing committee. Obviously, she's involved. There are other investigators in that area in North Carolina, in Virginia, in this whole mid-Atlantic area. So we're looking for a lot of involvement. And, of course, we involve members of the local community down there in the planning of our meetings. So we think we have a very nice formula for going to different places, and it's working out well. So anyway, to answer your question, we do publish this every year.
And it will be available.
It'll be available on our website,
Huntington-study-group.org. Well, my goal this year is to get prominent HD researchers from every state on the show.
Oh, great.
So maybe you can help me with that.
Well, you might have to go daily.
I know.
Yeah.
How many do you have now?
Well,
over 200.
We actually have 100 research sites worldwide, most of them in the Huntington Study Group. Most of them are in the U.S. and Canada, but we have sites in Europe, Asia, Australia, and South America. So but most of the studies that we do are really in North America, but we have done a few global studies with our colleagues in Europe also.
That's fantastic. We have a question from Facebook. James, did you want to cover that question for me?
Sure, I'm here.
Okay.
The person did not give me their name to say on the station, so I'm not going to. I heard that there was a new study to update the amount of people who have HD. The study was supposed to take place in the UK in 2011. When will the community see an update from the 1 in 30,000? So you can see that that's a big question nowadays.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to think of the investigator. This is not a study we've done. It's one that's been done in actually the London area. I know Dr. Sarah Tabrizi at the Queen Square Neurological Institute is one of the investigators there. But, you know, in any event, this work, the original work was published, I believe, in Lancet Neurology, and I think they're coming out with this update very soon. But essentially what it shows is what everybody else is saying, that HD is somewhat more prevalent than we think. Again, I don't want people believing that it's a common disorder at all, but it's much less rare than we had considered it to be.
Very good. Alrighty. Any other questions there, James?
No, but I will definitely let you know as they come in.
Okay, super. Okay, so looking forward to seeing the publication come out. Any updates on the clinical trials? And you said you have a new one coming online. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I'll give you just a brief review of where we are with our clinical trials. So we have two big clinical trials that are sponsored by the National Institutes of Health. One is called 2CARE, and that's looking at high dosages of coenzyme Q over a long period of time, particularly over 5 years period of time. And this study actually enrolled over 600 individuals in North America and in Australia. It was actually, our enrollment was completed in June of 2012. The study's going well, and we expect that the last enrolled of the 600 research patients will complete his or her 5 years in 2017, at which time we'll have the results shortly thereafter. So
okay.
It's a remarkable study because of the size of the study in terms of number of individuals and how long people have committed to be part of a study like this. So it's a tribute to not just the investigators who spent time on this, but to the patients and families who are participating.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and you discussed some of these studies on your program before, I know, just as updates. So the CREST-E study is looking at high dosage of creatine in Huntington's disease. And again, this is a large study. The target enrollment is 650 individuals, and about two-thirds enrolled. There's still a need for more research participants. It's not as long as the two-thirds trial, just 3 years, not 5 years. And it's expected that we'll complete enrollment by the end of 2014. So that is a project still enrolling, and people interested can, again, go to our website. All these trials are up there.
Mm-hmm.
We have a new trial that we began actually last year that we're very proud of called REACH2HD. I think we did a program on it also.
Yes, there's been a couple, actually.
With Dr. Dorsey. Well,
and
that was a study to look at a very interesting research compound that had an effect of reducing the adverse effects of metals in the brain. And there's some evidence in Alzheimer's disease that might be helpful in terms of thinking and cognition. Well, this is a study looking at the safety and best dose and the tolerability of this experimental drug. And it was planned to include 100 individuals enrolled over a period of 6 months, which was very ambitious, involving sites, 20 sites, I believe, in the U.S. and Australia. And the study enrolled ahead of schedule, which is really wonderful news for everybody. So we're just at the six-month study, so hopefully by the end of the summer in 2013, we should have some initial signals about how safe this is and perhaps how effective it is at what dosage. And then we're beginning another study in a few weeks. We haven't fully announced this yet because we're just getting our reviews by our institutional review boards, but if one looks at our Huntington Study Group site or the site of our sponsor called AuspeX, Pharma, AuspeX Pharma, PHARMA.com, we are examining a drug that works a lot like the tetrabenazine, fluzenazine drug that we developed that may turn out to be more effective or better tolerated. So we're looking at this drug to control movements in HD.
And is there a specific drug company involved in that too, or no?
Yeah, it's called AuspeX. The REACH2HD is a company called Prana Biopharmaceuticals in Australia, and this new one is called from a company called AuspeX, AuspeX, and they're headquartered in San Diego. So we're working with a variety of sponsors. I'm hoping that in about another 6 months, we'll have another one to go. These are relatively small
reaper
studies that are examining how safe and how effective these agents are. But compared to 10 years ago when we weren't doing any of these types of drug studies, it's really remarkable how the pace has picked up and also remarkable about how well the participation has been from the HD community. Of course, these are relatively small studies of 100 people or so, but even in our much larger studies, we're getting really good participation. It can always be better, but it's very gratifying.
Now, the new one coming up, AuspeX Pharma, is that going to be a small one as well?
It's a small one, 100 people also.
100.
Well, and that will be
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it'll be for people who are really having particularly problems with movements, involuntary movements, chorea, and the like, to see if these could be better controlled. The PRANA study, research team is focused on cognition or mentation. This one is focused on movement. So, and then we're, as I said, we're always trying to develop things because it takes a long time to do that and, and have more studies available for participation.
Speaking of that, how does the discovery go for new drugs? Are you approached by pharmaceuticals, or do you seek them, or how does that work?
Yeah, you asked a really good study, that question in the beginning. How does one decide what studies are to be done? How do they come about? And I think the answer to that in many different ways, and there's many factors. So the first thing that you want in a study is that there be some kind of rationale, some kind of scientific rationale for doing it. And sometimes there's a lot of scientific evidence and sometimes not. And sometimes you have to wait till there's more. So that's one factor, is whether we know about it scientifically, and hence the involvement of a scientist. The next factor is whether we know about this drug or compound, what do we know about it in terms of its safety? And that, of course, is a really very important issue. And people always say, well, if it's going to work, I'll try anything regardless of the safety. Well, it's not that simple. And, in fact, we don't want to expose people unnecessarily to unsafe compounds. So safety and practicality in terms of, you know, how available this compound is and how safe and well-tolerated is very important. And then the third thing, of course, is who's interested in sponsoring this? You know, is there a government sponsor? Is there an industry sponsor? Is there a foundation sponsor? So you have to pull together what I call the three important customers in clinical trials. The most important one are the research participants, the patients, the research subjects. The second are the investigators. And the third are the sponsors. So all those have to align well. And if they align around good science and good safety, there's usually a path forward.
Well, and then you have to have the facilities lined up, which you do. I mean, you have a fantastic network of clinics that you can do these studies. And that's taking you a long time to get that all, you know, organized.
Yeah, it takes a long time to organize it, but it also takes a long time to maintain it.
So
there's two things that do that. One is there's, you know, our research investigators are really active in terms of seeing and caring for HD patients and families, but they're also active as researchers, and, you know, that makes a big difference that they're fresh, they're well-tuned, and their institutions and their facilities likewise. And also, of course, it's not just the investigators. Our research coordinators in the Huntington Study Group really do a remarkable job. They're a mixture. They have backgrounds, clinical backgrounds, in ranging from nursing to occupational therapy to physical therapy to accounting to different things. So we're really blessed by some very good individuals who are collaborating as part of this network.
Yes. I think we had a question relating to REACH2HD, and it was, is REACH2HD, was that only for the United States and Australia, or were there other countries involved?
No, there were just the U.S. and Australia involved in that study. So the question is, you know, why do we pick one area or another? Well, it's not that we often get a chance to pick. It's really also where the sponsor is interested in terms of doing the study and where we have the capacity to do it. Again, these are small studies, so you can't do a study of 100 research subjects and spread it all over the world. It wouldn't be practical. So we do have to concentrate. But even the REACH2HD study, as I said, we had 20 sites selected, I think 19 of them enrolled research participants, including 5 sites in Australia and the other 14 in the U.S.
Do you feel like maybe the smaller studies are a little bit more easier to manage?
That's an interesting question. In a way, yes, because they tend to enroll faster and the study is completed earlier. But in a way, no, because once you put an effort into it, it doesn't matter if you have 100 people or 600 people, it's pretty much the same effort at planning and the safety surveillance required and the like. So are they easier to manage? I'm not sure. You'd have to ask the people who manage them. I think they scratch their heads.
It's still the same amount of coordination.
It's the same, everybody's working full time. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. James, you want to take a quick break for us? If you don't mind, Dr. Schulzen, you have a few more minutes to speak with us. I need to take a quick break here.
Sure.
And we'll be
Absolutely.
Right back.
Okay, here we go.
Dr. Schulzen, we're back, and thank you so much again for coming on the show. Let's get back to the questions. We had a question come into the chat room. James, do you want to ask the question? I think it was from Judy.
Yes, Judy wants to know,
okay.
Dr. Schulzen, if there are conclusions or information regarding ACR-16 trial.
Good question. So ACR-16 is a drug that was developed by a company called Neurosearch in Denmark. And we, the Huntington Study Group, working with the European Huntington's Disease Network, EHDN, have completed some studies looking at this drug and its ability to reduce involuntary movements in HD. And the initial sets of studies have been completed, and we can make the following conclusions. One is it appears to be a very safe and well-tolerated drug in Huntington's disease, at least over the period of the 6 to 12 months that has been studied. Number two is there is a tendency for this particular research drug to reduce the movements of HD. It's probably not yet as powerful or consistent as we would like to demonstrate it. We are planning to do a much larger study to really firm up our expectation that it would be, even though not very powerful, still an effective drug for controlling the movements and improving the movement in HD. The company Neurosearch was bought by a larger company, Teva Pharmaceuticals, headquartered in Israel, and that company has taken over the development. And my understanding is that they're very interested in continuing the research, and hopefully we could be part of that. And that's all I have to, I'm able to report at this time on ACR 16.
Fantastic.
The other name for it is Contexel. That's the brand name the company has. I'm not sure, maybe they've changed it, but it's a good question, and there's your update.
Speaking of drugs, I wanted to ask, too, and I've had this question come to me many times, is what is happening with the pharmaceuticals? Are they starting to look at Huntington's disease now as a, you know, a disease to repurpose certain drugs? Or there seem to be more drug companies interested. Do you think that's true?
I think it's very true. I think, as I said, compared to 10 years ago, no one knew about Huntington's disease. I think for a variety of reasons, the research that's going on, the advocacy from the community, the recognition in society about this disease, I think we played a little role in the development also of tetrabenazine or xenazine in Huntington's disease, which is now marketed by Lundbeck Pharmaceuticals. I always say that because when you see something go all the way through the research pathway and become actually a product, that companies become alert to it. You know, okay, you can imagine what the boardroom looks like and the CEO says, honey, go read about it, find out about it. You know, maybe we've got something here that's related to it. And I think from those inquiries, I would say that I get an inquiry about Huntington's disease once or twice a month from innovators and developers of medical products.
Right. And speaking of that, I kind of wanted to segue into another category of questions relating to the information that's been coming out to the community, antisense technology and the ASOs and gene silencing and RNAIs and all that stuff. Will HSG be working with those technologies in clinical trials?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So all these are really very interesting approaches to Huntington's disease. They're really going at the heart or the gene of the disorder.
Right.
And what they're trying to do is to turn off the expression of the gene that's responsible for Huntington's disease and whether they change the whether they prevent the gene from functioning at all or make its outcome more benign is something that really we want to accomplish. There's a lot of technical issues involved in this, particularly in terms of getting these compounds into the brain and being very specific about it. There's a lot of research that has to go on, but it's a real high-impact, high-outcome type of research. Having said all that, it's the type of research that you do in maybe two or three research participants first because of how technical it is involved. It's not just giving a drug, it's receiving a compound likely into the brain. And so these are studies that will involve, in the beginning, two, three research participants, maybe up to 10. If it looks okay and feasible, maybe a few more. And it's not something that would really benefit from a group like ours that has, you know,
okay,
multiple sites doing this, at least in terms of the early discovery and development process. So there are, I would expect that one, two, or three highly sophisticated research sites that really can take on this type of research will be doing this, either in the U.S., or outside the U.S. And so far, it's still much of a work in progress, but I want to emphasize how important it is. It's, as I said, going right to the gene defect, so it could have a real major impact eventually on the disease, but it's going to take some while to figure out the best approach to it and how to do it safely.
Mm-hmm. Now, is the FDA going to be approving those types of trials or whatever you would, well, I guess it would be a clinical or a procedural trial, wouldn't it? Like a medical?
Yeah, whatever it is, it involves an experimental intervention.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, it's a biologic. Yes, it comes under the regulation of the FDA. They would have to approve it. Now, this is really getting into the whole realm of what's called gene therapy.
Right.
And the FDA has approved research in terms of doing gene therapy. This has been going on for 10 or 15 years. They recently actually approved in some very rare childhood disorders some gene therapies. Well, like this, there's two of them right now. So it's in a very, very early stage, but I think people are encouraged. As I said, you know, there's a lot of things that determine whether you do a clinical trial. One is scientific rationale, and this makes a lot of sense scientifically. But then the other issue is how feasible and safe is it to do it, and that takes a little bit more thought in engineering.
Mm-hmm. And what are the other? What are the two? You said there were two that were done for different diseases.
They're really rare childhood diseases. One is, I think, called deaminase deficiency. These babies and children can be treated. I don't know that much about it myself, only to know that it has been actually approved. And I think, you know, some of them, there might be only 10, 15 children affected in the United States.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. But that's the way to, you know, that's okay. It's the way to start. And at least it appears that the concept will work. Of course, in these other disorders, you don't have to get the research drug into the brain. It's just into the body. So, as I said, there's another level of challenge for us.
So even though these may be biomedical trials or procedures or whatever you classify them as, the FDA, it falls under the FDA, even though it's not necessarily a drug.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
The FDA, actually, this is actually something I know about. This is my day job in a way. So the FDA not only regulates drugs, and not only regulate biologics, which is this falls under, but also devices. So if somebody comes up with a device that's new that has to go into humans in any way, the FDA regulates it.
The FDA also Medtronics.
Exactly. Yeah, mm-hmm. Medtronics. In fact, Medtronics, I believe, is one of the companies that's, you know, interested in HD amongst other device companies. So it also requires working together both in terms of doing devices and in terms of delivering biologics. But the FDA regulates that. They also regulate almost all the food that we eat, and there's a safety issue there. And they now also regulate tobacco products, so they have a big job.
Wow. Now, are you going to all the conferences around the country and the world for the science, or...?
Yeah, that's a good question. How much do you have to travel to get this information? you know, it's very... No, you just really raise a good question, Melissa, because you can learn a lot by through the media. I mean, whether it's on the internet or, you know, the science, you know, scientifically. But, you know, at some point you have to, you know, go to these meetings and hear people talk about it and talk about with them. And either in terms of a presentation or especially a poster presentation where people put it up and you actually get to meet the people and talk with them about it. So, yeah, I regularly spend time doing that in Huntington's disease. I usually attend two or three or four meetings a year, research meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, in other disorders like Parkinson's disease or movement disorders, I'll do that. So, yeah, I'm frequently at meetings, but But one can also get information without going to the meetings, including through a media like you do.
Yeah, I know. We've learned a lot here.
Yeah.
But you know, there's nothing like meeting someone in person, you know, eye to eye, basically elbow to elbow, just talking to them about the science. And so much can be synergistically worked on through connections and through, you know, personal contacts. I'm sure that's how you built your networks, you know. And, you know, we're just talking about the Huntington Study Group right now. You have also have the Parkinson Study Group, and that's a whole other venture, right? I mean, you started that
It's different. I'm not that active anymore in the Parkinson Study Group. I helped found it, but I've since given up the leadership of it. I'm very engaged in the Huntington Study Group, though. But, yeah, no, they're different types of groups, but the same idea about working in a collaborative fashion to develop treatments and make a difference for these disorders. But, you know, I should just one thing that you mentioned that struck me is, you know, you're talking about scientists going to these meetings and meeting other scientists and, and becoming inspired. One of the things I've really enjoyed about the symposia that we have that's attended by HD patients and families is how meaningful and sobering it is for the researchers to meet the people who are affected by this disorder.
Yeah.
And now I'm a clinician, so I see Huntington's patients and other patients all the time, but many of the scientists don't have that opportunity. And I could tell you it's incredibly valuable, and it really it's good for the patients to meet the researchers, but also good vice versa.
Well, I can't tell you how much I appreciate, and I know the community appreciates you coming on the show because, I mean, to actually get to speak to someone and hear someone of your caliber and your experience and your knowledge address the entire community is just fantastic, and I so appreciate it. I wanted to also let our audience know that I am working with Dr. Biglin, Dr. Dorsey, through researchforhd.org/telemedicine. We're doing a survey to see what the interest level is in the HD community for telemedicine. And I know they've been working with the Parkinson community for a while using this technology. Have you found it to be real helpful, Dr. Shulson?
Yeah, well, we're very excited about this. First of all, I should disclose that I was involved in training Drs. Biglin and Dorsey and getting them involved in HD research, so I'm delighted that they've taken it on, but that's just disclosure. But number two is this is really very interesting because what was found in Parkinson's disease in the studies by Biglin and Dorsey is that there was incredible acceptance by individuals to be seen by their physician or clinician remotely, even though they weren't there in person. And that's because it reduced travel, and it also brought into the environment members of their family or other care providers, such as nurses, who would participate all together, you know, at one time. So the quality of care was really judged to be as good, if not better, remotely than it was in person. So I think there's a lot of potential, and I know Dorsey and Biglin are heavily engaged in studying this in Huntington's disease. The one area I'm particularly involved in telemedicine is in research. So we do these research studies, and it's an incredible burden on research participants. Sometimes they have to come in once a week to have blood drawn or be examined and make sure things are going okay. Wouldn't it be nice if we could replace half or a higher percentage of those visits with a telemedicine visit that would not require people traveling, having to take off of work, family members, and the like. So I see a real potential there.
Makes sense.
Now, the media has made a tremendous difference, and I think we're going to more and more in the research realm be utilizing technology such as telemedicine.
it just makes so much sense to me, especially with a community that really does have a difficulty traveling, whether they have a movement disorder or a pain syndrome, like my son has a very severe pain syndrome. And so it's very difficult for us to even get to our clinic, much less do any kind of clinical trials. So having a telemedicine set up, whether it be through our local primary care doctor or in-home or whatever, would just be a fantastic thing for everyone. And I have to say, I put the survey out, I think it was Saturday night I put the survey out. We have more than 40 responses so far just in a couple of days. And I really want to stress the importance of the survey to the community, because this will give Drs. Biglin and Dorsey an indication of what the interest level is and whether or not they should go forward with putting this technology out for our community. And, you know, along with that, there are legal issues, portability and, you know, for the private sector and that kind of thing. So it's not just a matter of, okay, let's do it. It's a matter of, okay, what is the interest level? How many people do we really have that would be able to participate, who want to participate, and then go after the legislation and, you know, get it organized for us? But I have to tell you that out of 40 responses, 34 of them have, you know, typed in their comments to the effect of, this is really important, we need this, we want this. So, I mean, so far so good, and again, I just would stress that our community do the survey so that I have some information to give to the doctors and give them an indication of, you know, what the interest is. So, and I appreciate them doing this because, you know, we need all the help we can get, and to have doctors have so much passion and interest in helping us is really gold to me.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I think there's two footnotes to that discussion. One is your ability to do a survey in a few days is incredible, given the fact that it used to take us months or years to do a survey. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And number two is, in terms of telemedicine, there were three things that people resisted to as far as telemedicine. One was the cost that they thought, and of course, if there's an internet access, the cost is really the cost of an $85 camera, you know, that could be used and reused. But so one thing was the cost. Two was the idea that it was an intrusion into one's, you know, family or home or things like that. And in fact, one obviously has to be very respectful, but I think if one still maintains the one-on-one confidentiality between the clinician and the patient family, that's taken care of. So there's been kind of, I think, less resistance to that as people see how well it's worked. And, you know, the third thing has been the whole issue about privacy and confidentiality, but I think that's also being taken care of, and the type of telemedicine techniques being used are encrypted so as to reduce risk
right.
of hacking or anything like that. So I think what seemed like daunting obstacles have not quite disappeared, but they are much lessened, and I think the path forward is clear.
I do, too, and I think, you know, as time goes on, I mean, more and more people have smartphones, iPads, or, you know, computers that have the cameras already built in. And if you don't, maybe another family member does, you know. So I think it's something that the technology has gone quite, you know, global as far as accessibility and that kind of thing. So I think it's a really fantastic idea. I love the passion that I hear from the doctors, and I'm on board 100%, 110% to help in any way I can. James, do we have any other questions out in the chat room?
No, actually, everybody's been very happy to hear Dr. Schultzen on tonight.
Okay.
A lot of great information.
I think, did you have a question regarding the AAN, James?
No, actually, what I'll do is I'll get with Dr. Schultzen separately.
Okay, and then Judy had another comment.
Yeah, I could just
hear.
I just want to mention one other advocacy thing that made a big difference in terms of HD that was maybe a little tangential, and that's the work that was done principally by HDSA with the Social Security Administration to recognize HD as a disability in people who are affected by the disease. This is really big news.
Yep.
And it's a big change. I mean, other people worked on it, but I think HDSA really took it on with a passion and, you know, deserve a lot of recognition for getting this done. But this has a big effect, not just for the care of people and so that they get the disability that they deserve in a timely fashion, but also because it's enabling of research. So, you know, people are just more comfortable in their surroundings, one less little thing to worry about, and the ability to participate in research. So I just wanted to bring that up.
And also with that, our community has really stepped up and, you know, taken the role of advocate and gone to the representatives and reached out. And now James did his James Talk videos and put that out. That helped too. And, you know, it's a collaborative effort between, you know, the different foundations and the actual people who are advocating. And that, you know, that's the perfect combination. And, you know, that's what makes people aware and pay attention and realize that, okay, this is really something that we need. Having the compassionate allowance for the adult and the juvenile is fantastic. And,
yeah.
I mean, it took me 4 years to get my son on disability. So, you know, that shouldn't be. And I'm so happy to know that, you know, we now have compassionate allowance for adult Huntington's and compassionate allowance for juvenile Huntington's. And that was another thing I was going to ask you real quick. Regarding the juvenile Huntington's population, will there ever be clinical trials for juvenile Huntington's, do you think?
Well, first of all, there's no reason why there shouldn't be. There are issues of consent and assent, meaning the parent, you know, consenting for the juvenile, but those are surmountable issues. The question is, are we going to have research compounds that would be very suitable? I should tell you, though, the thing I'm encouraged about is in some rare childhood juvenile disorders, and I alluded to a few rare ones, there's research going on with drugs that are not too dissimilar from those that might be helpful in HD, and I'm hopeful and encouraged that if they show any good signals that this might be applied to HD. And I think for a variety of reasons, doing this in a population of juvenile HD, which is in a way the most serious type of condition, might be good for providing some signals as far as benefits. So to answer your question is there are not any going on right now. In theory, there's no reason it couldn't be done. So I'm encouraged, but we haven't done it yet. I should tell you that in our research studies we've done in HD, though, that we have allowed in some studies participation as young as 16 years old with some enabling by. But that does, you know, that's that doesn't answer your question. But there's no reason that we should preclude those who have, in a way, the most serious type of HD from the benefits of research.
Well, I know there's a lot of study going on with Jane Paulson and the natural history study and the kids' HD and all that, and that's fantastic. But I've had many, many questions from the community as to whether there will ever be any clinical trials for juvenile Huntington's disease, and that's come up quite a number of times. And I forgot to ask you, how is Predict HD going? I know that's
It's going well. Predict HD is a study of the Huntington's Study Group, led by Dr. Jane Paulson of the University of Iowa. This is a remarkable undertaking. I mean, this has been going on. I think they're moving into about its 10th year. And they're following individuals primarily who are known to carry the HD gene by virtue of undergone gene testing. It's, you know, they've learned an incredible amount of information, and they continue to learn a lot, too. What we'd like to do, of course, at some point is to be able to enroll this group of individuals in clinical trials in an effort to try to postpone or prevent the onset of HD. We did one study called Prequel. The investigators were Chris Ross and Kevin Biglin, to really look at the feasibility and the safety and tolerability, in this case, of coenzyme Q in this type of population. So you do all those really refined, sophisticated observational studies that Jane Paulson and her colleagues are doing, and you marry that with experimental therapeutics and clinical trials, and I think one has some real important potential for modifying the course of HD. Are we there yet? No way, but we're much closer than we were 10 years ago before the PREDICT project started.
Oh, wow. Now, is the PREDICT HD study still enrolling then?
It actually is in smaller numbers, but it is still enrolling.
Is that going to be an open enrolling study?
Well, I think there's a they're looking at a conclusion for
yeah.
this study, but it kind of spins off other studies, and they're also making their data available for people to do what we call data mining studies and
mm-hmm.
you know other studies. So
okay.
it's really it's really prompted a lot of research in its own right, and they really published a lot too. So you know, we are learning compared to what we knew about what we call pre-manifest or prodromal Huntington's disease. People carry the gene but have not yet manifested any kind of signs of HD. Compared to 10 years ago when we knew relatively little, we know a lot now about its biology and clinical features.
Now, so did the PREDICT come from the Pharos or?
Well, it came about the same time. So in 1997, and this is it's probably only of historical interest, a group of us were sitting around, myself, Jack Penny, who's since deceased, Jane Paulson, and a group of other people, and we said, now that we can find out who carries the gene or who doesn't, we should really do some studies to understand better what's going on. And there were two populations of people. One population is people who chose to undergo testing and through testing learn whether or not they carry the gene. And, you know, that turned out to be the PREDICT population. But we were also, and this is something I've been particularly interested, faced with the still vast majority of individuals who choose not to be tested for a variety of reasons but still want to participate in research, and
mm-hmm.
that became the Pharos study. So
they were
kind of birthed together
mm-hmm.
out of necessity and interest, and both have been, you know, really remarkable studies. We learned different things from those studies, but they've been very powerful and I think groundbreaking in a way.
Well, I often wondered about that because it seemed like they were two, like, similar observational studies going on.
Yeah, no, they were similar peas in a pod, but we were studying just different peas there. And the populations were different. The enrollment, interestingly, in Pharos was just over 1,000, and PREDICT, I think they passed that already. So they're large studies. And by the way, both studies were supported by the NIH, the Pharos study by the Neurological Institute and the Human Genome Research Institute, and the PREDICT study principally by the Neurological Institute. But they are remarkable studies.
Is the genome
the Pharos
group,
Pharos,
is that an NIH group?
Which one is that?
The
Human Genome Research Institute is a institute of the NIH, like the Neurological
That's
Institute.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, we've covered a lot of ground here.
Right.
I so appreciate you sticking with us here. Let's see. I don't know if we have any other questions out in the chat room, but Dr. Schulson, thank you so much for all that you're doing for both Parkinson's and Huntington's and all the other neurologic and genetic diseases and things that are happening to our people out there. And one other question I have had come across a number of times is, does Parkinson's and Huntington's come together?
Well, they bear some similarities, and they're both diseases of the brain. Huntington's disease, of course, is it only occurs because of the gene responsible for Huntington's disease. Parkinson's disease, which is much more common than Huntington's disease, there's probably about 1 million people as opposed to 30,000 people affected with Parkinson's disease as opposed to 30,000 with Huntington's disease. Parkinson's disease is much more common, and it's much more common, particularly in individuals as they age, and especially over the age of 55, 60, 65. So it's really a disease of aging. There are some similarities. There's certainly similar types of approaches in terms of how we do experimental research. The unmet needs abound with both disorders.
I've heard of a lot of misdiagnosis, too.
Yeah. Well, in a way, it's easier to diagnose Huntington's disease than it is Parkinson's disease. With Huntington's disease, you have to take a very good history, and particularly a family history.
Mm-hmm.
With Parkinson's disease, that may be insufficient, and it could look like other things, too. So it does require, it can be challenging as far as diagnosis goes. But
now,
I think we're...
Is there a blood test for Parkinson's?
No, there's not.
Oh.
No, there's not. Of course, there's a blood test in a way for Huntington's disease by virtue of the gene, but there's nothing even close to that. In many respects, we understand much more about the science, biology, and genetics of Huntington's disease, probably in order of magnitude more than we understand about Parkinson's disease.
Mm-hmm.
And Parkinson's disease may turn out not to be Parkinson's disease, but Parkinson's diseases, a variety of diseases that look similar but may have different causes.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, a lot of advances have been made in Parkinson's disease over the years and continue to be, but they are only similar by virtue of the fact being diseases of the brain that tend to progress over time. For which at one point there were no therapies at all for either disease, and now they're gradually coming on board.
Very good. Well, tell us, give our community an idea of what is on the agenda for HSG for this new year.
Well, as I mentioned, we're starting one study up now. We'll hope to have another one beginning in the end of next year. We'll have results of studies that are completed. We have our annual meeting that will be announced soon that will be in the Charlotte, North Carolina area, likely in very early November, and we'll post that on our website. I'm sure we'll get the information to you and encourage patients and families from that mid-Atlantic area to participate. And we're also involved in a lot of other educational and research programs that we're getting off the ground. So most of the stuff we do is kind of below the iceberg level. But the two things are, the clinical trials, the observational studies.
We'll be looking forward to seeing those come out, the new one. And that'll be done through San Diego.
Right. Actually, one of the previous studies that was done on Horizon study, was just published this month in what's called JAMA Neurology. So we usually
have a
link
to that on your website?
There should be by now, yeah. It was published last week. This was the study done of the compound that was shown to, or suggested to have some benefit in Alzheimer's disease and was applied to Huntington's disease, and we couldn't detect it. And when they repeated the studies in Alzheimer's disease, they couldn't detect it either. This was the so-called Russian antihistamine compound. But But, you know, there are false starts. There's no question about it.
Okay.
But the other,
well, this
the other,
is fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. So we're continuing to publish that, and we have a list of those publications on our website also. Our website was, you know, we all try to kind of keep these fresh every year, so we did it last year. We're going to freshen it up again, and we hope that people will visit at Huntington without the apostrophe S hyphen study hyphen group .org.
Okie doke. Now, people want to contact you. Can they contact you directly, or how can they?
Yeah, you know, there's a variety of ways. We have an 800 number that I don't have in front of me that's on our website also that talks about
okay.
the study. And my email address is available there also, as are the executive director of the Huntington Study Group. So, yeah, people usually have no problems getting in touch with me.
Very good. Well, again, I just want to thank you so much for coming on the show and filling us in on what's going on at HSG. And you're just a wealth of knowledge and information. We appreciate all that you're doing. And I think we better close the show now. We're getting ready to go off the air. And I just want to say thank you again. And this concludes Help for HD with Dr. Iris Schulzman. Thank you
My
all.
Pleasure.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in tonight. And don't forget to contact me at helpforhdinternational.org. Find us on Facebook, Help for HD, the HD View. Come back, listen to the recorded episodes. Don't forget, Dr. Schulzman was on also Help for HD Radio May 9th of 2011. Listen to that show, too. Get the free on-the-road Help for HD app at Help for HD International. Also available on the app is the original mobile connection to education resources and information about JHD and HD. Good night, everyone. Have a great week. We'll talk to you next Monday.
Good night.